The Babylon Project was our last best hope for peace. It failed. But in the year of the Shadow War, it became something greater. Our last best hope for victory. The year is 2260. The place, Babylon 5.
Hello and welcome to Chats, the television podcast, season 6, Chatsalon 5. When I thought I was going to die, even after everything that's happened, I realized I didn't want to let go. I was willing to do it all over again. This time I could appreciate the moments. I can't go back, but I can appreciate what I have right now. And I can define myself by what I am instead of what I'm not. And what am I? I'm Alan, that's Magellan. Everything else. Hey, what's up? Everything else is negotiable. Hi, Magellan. Ooh. Yeah? Yeah? Ooh. We're never going to run out of time here on Chats Salon 5. I forgot what the podcast is called. It's a show where we talk about Babylon 5. And this week, we're changing things up. This first episode that we were discussing this week is so meaty that we decided to just, like, make this our episode.
Yep. Also, personal scheduling reasons.
So this week, we are discussing Season 3, Episode 20 of Babylon 5. And The Rock cried out, "No hiding place." It was written by J. Michael Straczynski. It was directed by David J. Eagle. It aired October 14th, 96, and it takes place from December 7th to the 11th of 2260. Magellan, what happened in And the Rock Cried Out, No Hiding Place?
Well, Alan, I'm glad you asked. In this episode, some religious acquaintances of Brother Theo's... Did you write this one?
I wish I did.
Some religious acquaintances of Brother Theo's come to the station. Meanwhile, Londo Malari is instructed to end his feud with Lord Rifa, even as he conspires to get rid of Jakar. Alan, what'd you think of the best titled episode we'll ever come across, and The Rock Cried Out, No Hiding Place?
One of the best episode titles, one of the best episodes of Babylon 5, to be honest with you, like, to be supersonic with you. It is so good at setting up your expectations like a fun game of T-ball and then just knocking them down and doing things. Like, it's great that that summary is written the way it is. It's clearly written by someone who watched the episode and decided to fully bury the lead, which I love, because, like I said, you spend a lot of this episode thinking that either Jakar is going to get killed or Londo is going to get in trouble or Rifa is going to take over.
Yeah,
and
something's going to happen to Veer.
Veer's going to get killed. Londo threatens Veer, and that's really scary. And then you're like, oh, this Brother Theo stuff is not going to be important. And none of that is true. The Brother Theo stuff is fantastic. The Rifa stuff is incredible, iconic, important, etc., etc. It's so good. It's so what I want out of Babylon 5. Just politicking and subversion of expectations and good performances and good use of music and set building. And oh my God, it's just a flawless episode, honestly.
Yeah, I agree. Really, really fun. One of my faves so far.
Yeah.
Because it kind of, you know, we don't get a lot of, I guess we do get some intrigue episodes, but this felt purely intrigue in the way that I finally started watching a little Game of Thrones this week.
Oh, bummer.
I figure now's the time.
Perfect time to start, for sure.
So I watched the first two episodes. This kind of felt like the closest that Babylon 5 is going to get to a Game of Thrones. Like, we've arranged a beautiful set piece murder of like a major character,
yeah,
kind of thing.
And it's different than, and maybe this is more me like taking a dig at modern Game of Thrones, which is
a wild thing to say.
But ever since they've stopped having to adapt the books, the showrunners, in my opinion, have kind of like leaned really hard into stuff that makes for a good water cooler discussion. Like, oh my god, that part where the lady that did the thing with the tits, or like that part where the Red Wedding, even though the Red Wedding is from the books, but it's like the Red Wedding kind of put them on this track of like, people like it when somebody dies. And when somebody dies in this episode, it's a huge moment, but it's not what you expected. It doesn't feel like this is what we were, it felt like we were building to something completely different. And at the last minute, they're like, oh, no, 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 no. You weren't paying attention. Actually, we had all of the pieces in hand. This is what we were building to this whole time. How excited are you for that? And it manages to be thoughtful and exciting and like have seemingly long-lasting consequences on the show. It has to. And then also they have a B-plot that complements it extremely well. Being about integrity and being about how do we, what does resistance mean? How do we change the status quo? And what are the battles of my of men even worth? Like, why do we have all these dumb conflicts? Meanwhile, you turn and there's like five different Centauri threatening to kill each other for the same stupid reason. It's just delicious. And the episode starts with some good stuff. It starts with a countdown that also goes into the other episode. We have watched Shadow Dancing, just for people's awareness.
Yeah, we were going to talk about both this week, but we didn't on the fly decision.
Mm-hmm. So the Z minus thing is in Shadow. It's in starting in this one. They say Z minus 14 days. This is presumably until the finale or whatever happens. Something that happens in the finale, because
you gotta imagine. I mean, Z is like Zahadum.
Zahadum, right? Like, right? Yeah.
I mean, given that the finale is called Zahadum, I'm assuming that's where we're going.
Yeah, we have no reason not to. So they're kind of doing this countdown, which is just like, what is this even counting down to? And then.
I think that's kind of a pet peeve of, I don't know, I can't decide. I think that's cheesy when
it
shows
is cheesy.
Do that. But I guess there are ways to do it well. And this just kind of feels like not necessary.
Especially because you know it's the end of the season. You're like, yeah, they're going to do the thing at the end. Like, duh, they have to.
Yeah, and it's also like, I like it when, if it's an episode that jumps around in time. But this isn't jumping around. It's as linear as Babylon 5 normally is.
Exactly.
So it doesn't really serve a purpose.
Mm-hmm. And this is like the third, maybe fourth time I've fallen for this. Every time an episode starts with an Ivanova audio log, some shit happens. It's always either a finale or the penultimate episode, and it's like, she's just like, shit, you know, captain's log, you know, people are doing stuff, people are mad, and people are stressed anyways. And that's always the signal that like, yep, something is happening this week. That's been our signal.
So here's something interesting for you. I watched this episode with a friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
You know who I'm talking about.
I do, probably. I do. Ronald McDonald.
Yeah. Joe Biden. We were having a conversation.
Wow.
Just about some of his policies.
And, yeah,
I think it was really productive. Actually,
this Londo guy's got good ideas. No, Joe, stop! No,
wait. If only there was someone who could shake hands with Londo and Jakar. He's a centrist. I don't know.
I know. You're good.
And this was this person's first episode of Babylon 5.
I was thinking about that. I was like, is this a good episode for new people? That's great that you did it.
And it was, because Ivanova at the very beginning was like, here's the shit that's going on.
Yep.
And also like a delightfully horny episode between Sheridan and Delenn, like the most fun and obviously flirty that they've been.
Yeah, like wholesome flirty.
So it's pretty easy for someone to be like, oh, they're like a thing, right? And he's like in charge and she's like in charge in a different way.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Like, oh, this lot. Oh, these guys all have the same hair, so they're like together.
Together,
but they hate each other. Something.
And the skeletons in the back, part of it. I don't know why I had to channel that now. Now's the time.
This is a good first one. I mean, not ideal because it's the third to last episode of season 3, but at least if you watch it with someone and it's their first one, they can like fully understand what's going on.
And we'll talk about the moment, but the idea of the trope that's used in the moment is like really good, because it kind of dictates to the viewer how they're supposed to feel. Like, as long as you understand the basic concept of dissonance or irony, you're like, okay, this is sad. The music is happy. Okay, I know how to feel now. Like, you kind of can come to terms with it just because of the direction and the way it's like shot and stuff. So, but we'll get there. Speaking of shot composition, there's Jakar talking about how he wants to send bodyguards with all the telepaths. And he's saying, like, you guys need us as much as I need you, Ivanova. If the symmetry were any more perfect, I would think that one of us would break into tears. Like, I love you, Jakar, so much. I want you to be my dad really badly. Be my dad. Put me on your knee and tell me stories about life. Londo comes right out of the gate with this episode, asking Veer to get Jakar off of Babylon 5 to have him tried and fucking executed. Instant power play. Let's see how this goes. I'm sure it'll go super well.
How did you feel about Londo's treatment of Veer in this episode?
It's kind of like what I've always figured Londo actually felt about Veer. Like, they clearly have a respect for one another, but the way Londo's been going, it's like he is down a path that he can no longer dig himself out of at all, and Veer is the first casualty of this new life decision. So it kind of like made sense, but it sucks.
It's hard to interpret for me right now because I think we initially interpreted the moment where Londo is like, all right, Morden, I'll be your buddy, as him being evil again. And then a listener said, well, maybe he's like got a long play in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And this episode would seem to support that Londo's thinking 10 steps ahead. So it's sort of like either you can read him fucking with Veer and manipulating him as like just awful and him being a bad dude who's just trying to kill Reefa for petty reasons. Or you can see it as Londo being like, I have to do whatever it takes to fight the shadows. And like, Veer's going to hate me, but I have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think there's a somewhat,
there's a more friendly or more like sympathetic
more
read of Londo.
Forgiving, yeah, reading of Londo. Mm-hmm. And I'm just not sure which one is accurate right now.
Yeah, it's hard to tell right now, but it is definitely frustrating and sad to see Veer so afraid and uncomfortable with like the one person that he can usually confide in. And I mean, there's the shot too where he goes to Jakar to ask him for the stuff, and he's so scared he can't even look at Jakar in the eye or the guy who's like guarding his door. He's just like, yeah, Jakar, like, Londo wants you to get the fuck off of here. Bye. Like, he has stake in the game, but he has no belief in what he's saying anymore. And because Londo is making him do this awful shit, and he doesn't want to be a part of it. Yeah.
Well, it's even worse than, I mean, it's worse than him just saying, like, get out of here. He lies about Natoth, right?
That's what it is. Right.
Yeah. Londo says, I remember Veer, I remember back from season one, he really liked Natoth. Remember Natoth? What a great character.
Remember she was like two different actors? Remember Jakar's aide, Natoth? Remember? And then he goes, I still have the claw marks. Like, great, Veer and Natoth definitely had kinky sex. That's so great. and he threatens Veer's family in that scene too, which is so bad.
Yeah, it's really... it's bleak. I mean, it's the cruelest that he's been to Veer, ever.
Absolutely. Bar none.
So you have to wonder if, like you're saying, if it's that he's going down a path and things are getting worse, or if it's like a calculated move to be an extra jerk.
Yeah, that's a good point. Other plot that sort of starts to bubble up here is the brother Theo stuff. He introduces the gang to his religious friends, who I really expected to not... I just expected to not give a shit about this plot. I was just like, this is unnecessary. We've never really cared about Brother Theo, except for the one episode where we really, really liked him. Yeah. What was that episode called again?
Passing Through Gethsemane.
Gethsemane, right. Thank you. And it turns out that these religious leaders, the Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, and Jewish leaders... they're all really interesting, and the reason they're on the ship is not just like there's a religious conference like in season one where
I was just gonna say they called back the three actors that they like.
Yeah, they finished tryouts, and they were like, you're also the three or four most popular faiths, and so we're going to let you guys be back on the show. It's such a good reinterpretation of that idea, too, of like, what does bringing religious people to Babylon 5 do, and why do you do that? And in that episode, it's just like, we're all one. It's so optimistic. Like, we're all important and valid in our own ways. And in this, it's like, all right, motherfuckers. Resistance does not come without struggle. You need to accept that things are hard. And you need to get better at this. Like, specifically, the other ones don't really get a lot of dialogue. It's Reverend Dexter who gets most of the talking. And he's just great. He just, like, snacks on scenery and delivers these great monologues. Character. Basically confirming that, like, the resistance on Earth is still very much active. The common person doesn't think that what they're doing on Babylon 5 is good, but the resistance does. You guys have people's support back home.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Which is great. That's, like, the main takeaway from their stuff. And then, obviously, they have the sermon at the end. But even just his conversations with Sheridan along the way are so packed with meaning and deliciousness. Like, the whole... Yeah, and legs are funny when you're older. Like, when you sit down, you want to get up, and when you get up, you want to sit down. And I'm like, damn, I can relate. Or when your worry tank gets full, people stop coming to you because they don't want to fill it anymore. Basically, telling Sheridan, like, you need to know when to ask for help. You need to use your contacts, and for the love of God, flirt with your girlfriend more, you stupid man. She likes you. Bring her to the war room. You guys can flirt and save the world together. What a thought. And Sheridan's like, flirting. Interesting plan.
Right. Yeah, I love that scene. And it's so... You can tell a scene is well structured when characters kind of go through different phases of how they feel about the other person in the scene.
Because
Sheridan at first is like, okay, what's this guy all about? And then he's kind of like, this guy's amusing. And then he's like, fuck this guy. Then he's like, okay, actually, this guy's awesome.
Actually, yeah, right.
I appreciated the performance there. And I think that, freaking what's his name? Bruce Boxleitner did a good job of making the most out of that in response to, like, the monologue that's really good.
Right. Is it at the end of this episode, or is it in Shadow Dancing when he has the really good... No, it's in this episode, when he has the conversation with Delenn in the war room as a result of this. Mm-hmm. I loved that, by the way. The two things I loved about the religious plot were, A, the fact that the show is actually addressing that if it's going to have one of its main themes be religion and how faith guides us and directs us and motivates us, and also have it be a show about war, they need to, like, address that. A lot of the biggest conflicts in history were started by people who were religious. And religion doesn't mean anti-war. It can, but it can also be a motivator for, like, what's worth living for and what's worth fighting for.
Right. Well, and it's also interesting, like, is religion by nature conservative? Not necessarily. Right. Like, this episode would seem to indicate that religion can... be radical or used for radical purposes.
Very much so. Because these guys coming on and being like, I'm not going to tell you not to fight. In fact, I'm going to tell you, keep the good fight going. God is on your side. That kind of thing. They're called the Army of Light for a reason, damn it. It's not just a Minbari thing. It's just like a, positive spiritual imagery thing.
Yeah.
And so Sheridan goes to the war room and kind of starts doing some planning stuff. He notices that the shadows are attacking, like, specifically around civilian refugee camps and planets and not going for them. And he's wondering why. And he's like, that's really weird. And he has a moment where he's like, oh, shit, they're doing the thing where they have everybody cluster in one place and feel safe. And then they're going to nuke us. And he just name drops. He's like, yep, that's Nagasaki, that's Hiroshima, that's San Diego, which is adorable.
Like that was kind of gross.
Yeah, come on, guys. You don't just get to, like, tack on your sci-fi history onto real-world history, like, in that. I get what you're doing. I can see how that looked good, but it's very, like, it's overly... It's reaching. And Delenn is like, so what's your plan? Like, He says basically we need to do something back to them. We need to think like them. Because he's a military man. That's how you win wars, is you think like the enemy. I read Art of War once. Mm-hmm. And Delenn, in a move that you don't really see in shows like this, is like, hey, I know we're doing a war, but like thinking like the enemy is not how you like continue a society after conflict. Thinking like the enemy is how you become the enemy. If you keep doing this, you're worse. You're as bad as them, if not worse. Just because you're talking about we need to nuke them first or we need to plan faster is not good. And, you know, weren't we talking, I think, last week or the week before that about the Minbari conflict? That was last week. And how you right. have to talk about this stuff now and not after the war because power is consolidated during war. Yeah. So you gotta. She reminds him to keep that in mind. And that's, you know, a great moment from Delenn, honestly.
Yeah, that was cool. Something came into my mind. I just wanted to return to this episode felt generally like more playful and jokey than other scripts we've seen in a while, I feel like. In some ways it worked and in some ways it were kind of, I don't know, they felt a little weird. Like Delenn was definitely characterized in this episode much differently than we've seen her, mm-hmm. I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to feel about that.
Well, what do you mean? So what part of her characterization do
like
you think is...
Like, she's kind of like the first scene where she comes to talk to Sheridan, he's looking at the attacks pattern. She's kind of going on her whole thing about, like, oh, someone was saying that you were grouchy, and I looked up grouchy, and it said,
oh,
like,
my God,
whatever. Yeah. Yeah, that whole thing.
What's difficult for me is I think she's being recharacterized too much in this show in response to Sheridan. Like, a lot of her characterization comes from, like, yeah, I agree with you there. Because in there, she's, like, silly, and they bring back the whole crotchety joke over and over again. This is the same Delenn who, like, earlier in the season was, like, we're bringing the fire on the shadows. Time to show everybody the White Star in like a foolishly bold military play. Because there it's supposed to be like, oh, Sheridan, you need to know not to be too bold like Delenn. It's like they just seem like they're writing Delenn inconsistently to match Sheridan or to kind of be an opposite to Sheridan.
Yeah, and it feels like, I don't know. Like this is the episode where they kiss at the end.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time, right? We haven't seen them kiss before.
It's definitely framed like it's the first time. It's definitely framed like it's a huge deal.
And it just feels kind of weird to me that in order to gear us up to that moment, we see Delenn kind of acting the most like a rom-com female lead.
Mm-hmm.
In like just a cheesy movie written by a dude.
Yep.
I don't know.
Have you seen this?
It was amusing, and I liked it, but it definitely didn't feel fully faithful to Delenn or fully faithful to like what is great about their relationship. I think the scene where they're like doing the military strategy is better in that respect.
Right.
But the intro scene was it was off.
Mm-hmm. So Magellan, I just got called up for dinner. I think this is a good pause point.
Okay.
And then we can come back because we still have all of the Reefa stuff, which will be like a lot. And then I also have emails.
Great.
So if you're okay, we don't even have to say, like, we can just not say anything and cut back in seamlessly. Or do you want to say, like, we'll be right back to finish up this?
Let's take a break just to give people a break point.
Okay, sure.
And then I have a follow up to my jokey thing that I want to talk about. Like, I think that Brother Theo was joking in a way that was bad.
Oh, okay. You want that in here?
No, that could be where we come back from the break. If you
know. Oh, okay. Okay, I'll make like a note of it.
Or whatever.
Jokey Theo. Gotcha. All right.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. So I'm just gonna cut us back in. So a lot happens in this episode, as we've said. There's still a lot to talk about, but we're going to take a brief break and we'll be right back to finish talking about. And the Rock cried out, "No hiding place." Hey, we're back. Wow, that was a fun break. We had a good time. Magellan, you mentioned wanting to circle back and talk about Theo some more.
Yeah. I was talking before we broke about how to me it felt like this script was like a little jokier than most episodes. Another character that I thought was kind of oddly characterized, and maybe I'm misremembering him, was Theo, because it felt like every one of his lines was like an awkward, sarcastic joke.
Yeah.
About the other religious leaders. Like, oh, as long as, like, oh, you think that singing is beautiful music? It certainly isn't. It's like everything's overworded. So he's like, if you believe that your singing is a beautiful, joyful noise, in fact, it's actually not a joyful noise at all.
It's like 8 minutes later and he's still talking. You're like, what was the point?
I'm sure that you feel somewhat embarrassed now because I took what you said about your voice being a joyful noise and I inverted it in order to say to you that in fact that voice of yours, while God loves it and created it, is not actually joyful at all, and I don't think you should sing.
Is Brother Theo going to stick around? Is he dead? Is he gone?
I didn't even know they were still there.
This is the last episode he's on. Thanks. Thank you, Babylon 5 Wiki. He's not
really.
Back. Yep.
Oh, that's kind of sad.
Yeah, I'm so sad. I'm gonna stop reading. And the Rock cried out, "No hiding place, Brother Theo." Yeah, it's like the side characters never get consistent characterization, I feel like, and we just talked about how Delenn even doesn't have it. So like, consistency is not the focus in this season. It's more like plot consistency. Like, things are happening for a reason. But I don't think those two things have to be mutually exclusive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you can have Delenn be a consistent character and also have the shadow plot go where you want it to. Mm-hmm. Which is apparently like guys. Was it this episode where they dealt with all the shadow stuff, or was it no, because the second one's called Shadow Dancing. Of course not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't really do a lot with it in this episode, which is
Yeah, the only thing that it really culminates to is they're trying to get that's the second one where they're trying to get the aligns to work with them.
Yes, that's the beginning of the second one. Yeah,
it's beginning of the, well, next week's first one, I guess, but the correct second one we watched.
Second one that we watched.
But the reveal, at least in relation to the shadow plot at the end, is Delenn saying, "Hey, baby, I know that it takes a lot to get you to want to kiss me, so I decided to build you hundreds of ships." And then Sheridan was like, "All right, now my motor's running. Now I'm ready for that smooch."
Them kissing in front of a battalion of 1,000 psychic warships is like the most charged imagery of all time.
Right. Yeah.
Just like, you know what I really love is war. I really love war and combat. And this is also in conjunction with like the darkest scene of the show happening like basically simultaneously. And then they just cut over to this. He's like, "Delenn, I love you." And it's like arming missiles. Beep, 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 beep. Are you fucking kidding? Because he's arming his missiles, you know?
Yeah, his dingus.
His dank is dongus.
His dongus. You know, it is definitely this like fetishization of genius military leaders as like our saviors.
Mm-hmm.
And it, yeah, I don't know. I feel very conflicted because finally we get that kiss.
finally, thank God, and what a kiss it was.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really rotating their faces.
Is that what makes a realistic kiss?
Go back and take a look at that kiss, everybody, and you'll notice that they're rotating their faces back and forth like windshield wipers. They're really kissing.
Sorry, I just had a blue screen of death mentally.
Could you pull it up now and just look at it?
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm
so
trying.
You can okay. corroborate. But it's like the moment. What's interesting is how John is pushed to bring.
There's so much rotating. He's like jiggling her lips.
Yeah.
Yikes.
It's interesting that like. The arc for Sheridan in this episode is about bringing people in on your responsibility, which is such a great part of that speech by the Reverend there, of like the worst officers were the guys who felt like it was their burden to carry on their own and like their responsibility and blah, 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 blah.
Right, right, right.
So Sheridan's arc is like, okay, I'm going to actually fully share the burden with Delenn. And that is the moment in which their relationship truly becomes a fully shared, acknowledged romantic thing. That's cool. And I'm glad that the kiss was saved for a moment that felt that meaningful, because instead of the kiss being the moment of like, ooh, we like each other, it's yeah. like we are committed to each other. But the fact that that commitment is intrinsically tied to like, and we are going to go off and kill together.
Yeah, we're gonna do a kill. We're gonna do several kills.
We're gonna do a lot of big kills. You know, I don't know.
It's the thing that they bonded over is conflict. Yeah. Their love was fostered on the battlefield. Can love bloom on the battlefield? Babylon 5 says, heck yeah, smoochy smooch.
Smoochy smooch.
I am definitely curious if they ever address this. They might not. I've come to accept that they might just not. Like the way that the show
it's
fetishizes war.
No. Yeah, it's hard to know because definitely when John... flash to the future, we saw that shit's gonna go bad for
yes.
them. So we know that this is not gonna be like a ride off into the sunset kind of relationship. But like, the show just doesn't deal that critically with kind of like glorifying military leaders, with glorifying police, or at least like permitting police violence. And then yeah, the stuff that we talked about with Delenn consolidating power. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, there's still a lot of show left, and it seems like this shadow fight is I thought was going to be like the arc of the show, but it feels like it's actually the arc of season 3.
Right. Like we're going to come to some sort of head this season.
Yeah, it feels that way.
You know. It's been curious, too, like, seeing what is actually going to be a long-term arc, like, what we expected and what's not. Like, I thought the telepath stuff was going to stick around longer than it kind of has. And I know it's not done yet.
Yeah.
It's kind of on the back burner. But between the shadows and the telepath stuff, I'm kind of like, what is the core conflict of Babylon 5? And that's a bigger question
yeah.
for us to kind of address as we go on. But
right.
I know that season 4 is, like... considered very cohesive and singular. So once we kind of figure out what that is and what that conflict is, it'll make more sense where the trajectory of the show is supposed to go. Because 4 was supposed to be the end, remember?
Yeah.
And then 5 is like, but anyways, we have navigated not talking about it for long enough, and we're now going to talk about the greatest plot, maybe of Babylon 5 so far. Technically the B plot of this episode concerns Londo and Lord Reefa. And Londo wants to kill Jakar. So he wants to send Jakar to the Narn homeworld. Jakar wants to avoid this by going... He gets himself smuggled into the Narn homeworld by Garibaldi. And there's this amazing scene where he's, like, talking to one of his men, and they're telling him, like, Everything here is terrible. We're suffering from cosmic winter. We've been nuked into oblivion. Look outside. And we cut to outside. And it's so tragic and sad. And it's just all red and bleak. And he's breathing from a mask because the air isn't even safe anymore. And then they cut brilliantly to Rifa, and he's setting up an abandoned building to look like a Centauri palace. So yeah. When Emperor Dark Cartagia comes, he'll like be comfortable. And you just see all these Narn slaves putting up Centauri architecture, and it's like, shit. You really can't say much more than that scene says, or that shot says, with your like what your choice of actors and players is. Rifa is like, you know, we have this whole plan set up, and then we captured Jakar, we'll kill him, and then we'll also bring the guy Londo's head. We're gonna be great. I'll be emperor. It's gonna be super good. No problems to be seen.
I was kind of confused. This is interesting to me, the way that Centauri court politics works.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I reflect on this, the wiki description says, meanwhile, Londo Mollari is instructed to end his feud with Lord Rifa. And I am kind of wondering, the guy who he was talking to.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, I believe was Martin O'Malley, a 2016 Democratic presidential candidate.
Kind of looks like him.
And then earlier life, I think that's who that was.
I forgot about Martin O'Malley. Thank you.
Who was the 61st governor of Maryland from 2007 to 2015.
Really?
Yeah, he was born in Washington, D.C. in 1963.
What do you mean, Wikipedia? What?
Dude, he's also Brolic. What?
Wait, Martin O'Malley's brother?
No.
Or Martin O'Malley?
Himself.
Yeah, Martin O'Malley is definitely, he's quite Brolic.
There's
can you send me a picture of Brolic Martin O'Malley, please?
Yeah, I'm going to send you this Jezebel article, the headline of which is, would you have sex with Martin O'Malley?
No. I mean, do send it, but no, I wouldn't.
Come on, guys. Check the pic. No, you might change your mind.
Is that what it says in the headline of the article? Would you have sex with Martin O'Malley? Hold on. Please click it. You might change your mind. He has a two-pack.
Yeah, he's got something happening there.
Oh, I don't like people on Twitter being like, damn, this presidential candidate's thotty as hell. I do not.
Yeah, no. I mean, he's not in it anymore, so.
True. But still.
Doesn't affect us.
He's 2016 Twitter. Man.
His policies are probably bad or something.
Mm-hmm. He didn't win, so bye.
Yeah.
Canceled.
So, anyway, the thing that I was thinking about was...
The guy's like, no more ward. Stop fighting Rifa.
Right, so I'm thinking about how Londo was talking about, like, oh, in the good old days, we'd always poison each other. And I'm wondering, like, the guy, the Duke guy or whatever, who said... This has to stop.
Mm-hmm.
If he was kind of saying, like, one of you needs to just kill the other guy, because that's how both of them took it.
Right. They didn't take it as, like, be the better man. And, like, the way that Jakar, when he spoke to his father, was like, the way you win is by being the better person. Mm-hmm. They were like, no, win is what they're telling me to do.
Yeah, just please win. Because Rifa saying, like, I'm going to bring the emperor the head of Londo Mollari.
It's like...
Like, why would the emperor like that?
It's like, wow, I love it.
Maybe they're into that. Like, you dominate your political rivals.
It's possible. I think they definitely did take it like that. I don't know. Well, we don't know much about Cartagia or his administration, if you will. And, like, what they actually want. Because we haven't met him yet. But the voices of the people who have, like, worked for him are definitely, like, trying to... I think they're trying to consolidate power. They're trying to be like, let's have one of you... And your families be in power because the two of you kind of doing this is causing a mess back home, which is basically what that guy says.
Yeah.
So anyways, they're both like, hey, come on. I'm going to kill you. And then we get to the stuff, right? Is there anything before the stuff?
Well, we kind of talked about Londo manipulating Veer, which relates because then Rifa captures Veer.
Mm-hmm.
And
great scene.
Yeah, has a wonderful... I think my favorite scenes of anything are the, like, villain is kind of making sense scenes.
Yeah. Yep. We're not so different, you and I.
Yeah, and his, like, Veer, Londo treats you like shit.
Yeah.
I will help you. You have no reason to be loyal to him at all. So, like, let's just team up.
Let's just make out. Let's just have a party, and you can be on my side, and you can... I mean, we'll kill him, but then also you can have a nice job, and we'll keep your family alive.
Yeah. And you know that there's a part of Veer that's going, he does suck. He really does suck big time.
He did threaten to strip my family naked and walk them through the square and then cut their heads off. Like, he did say that.
Yeah. And then the... I appreciated that we didn't have a moment where Veer sold Londo out, because I think that just would have really ruined the Veer character and like what he represents as Londo's right. moral compass. And so to have it be a telepath ripping it from his mind just makes it everything worse for Veer, which makes the end of when he's like, fuck you, Londo, even more powerful.
Yeah.
And it moves the plot forward without us having to wait a couple scenes for that to happen.
Exactly. That interrogation scene's weird. Because that guy's got a giganto forehead. Big Centauri forehead. And he's just like staring really tightly at Veer. And then he pulls that info out. And Rifa's like, wow, thanks. Now I know what to do. And now I know how to kill you, to kill Londo. This is going to go super well for me.
Mm-hmm.
This was a moment where I wrote in my notes. Because... No, the second episode is the one where I was like, or the other episode, Shadow Dancing, is where I was like, this is weird. Why did it end like this? But this one, I'm like, okay, something is either going to happen to Rifa or Jakar right now. Someone is dying. It just feels like it. The music is swelling. Someone's going to do something. I did not expect the way it actually went in the slightest, which is why this is one of the most impressive scenes for me.
That's interesting because I fully expected it.
You expected it? So. Yeah. This is important to mention also. This is like this Rifa Jakar scene is intercut with Reverend Dexter having a sermon talking about how the enemy is hate, the enemy is difference and ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just literally cut to this shit. And we also, during all of this, cut back and forth to, on one hand, I mean, Rifa's getting murdered. And on the other hand, they're having like a uproarious, happy church song about how, you know, the rock, there's no hiding place behind the rock and all that stuff.
Yeah, and like all these sinners are gonna get killed.
Exactly. So Jakar's got in chains or whatever. He's with some other Narn, and Rifa's like, nice, I'm gonna get Londo next and I'm gonna kill you and it's gonna be sick. And then Jakar's like, oh, I have this thing, just like weird, just check it out. And it's a hologram, and Londo's like, hey guys, hello, it's me, Londo. I've lost my Londo impression.
Just say Mr. Garibaldi.
Mr. Garibaldi. There it is.
Yeah.
Mr. He's like, yo, Rifa, buddy, you thought you had this? All of the guards behind you are mine. I love it when somebody isn't there, but they address the room. It's like one of the,
yeah,
my favorite dumb things. Like, yo, the guys here left and right, they're mine. And then they put their guns down. And he's like, the Narn in front of you, also mine. Jakar, mine. I promised I would free 100, at least 100 or whatever. And it was like 200 Narn refugees, 100 now and 100 after he does the thing that I'm telling him to do, which is to kill you. Don't bother running. Nobody's going to find you. Fuck you, Rifa. I win. And then Jakar's like, all right, guys. So keep his... so fucked. Keep his neck. Keep his face. They need to identify him. Other than that, go off, fam. And then...
And then he frames Rifa later for working with the Narn.
Correct. Right after all this stuff, he's like, yeah. And Rifa's the one who did all this stuff. And he's the one who led to the Narn homeworld being attacked and all this stuff. It's great. And they all go after him, and he's trying to run away as the prayer, as the choir is going off. And he's getting brutally, brutally murdered. It's very Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
We were talking also before this about the decision to have like the nice church song over like scenes of brutal murder.
Yeah.
Because it's a like surprisingly common trope in television and cinema, actually.
More yeah, common the juxtaposition in movies, I think. Of music to action.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess specifically with like violence.
Right. Soundtrack dissonance is the like the TV trope thing, I guess, if people are like curious. But yeah, it's just something you feel like you've seen everywhere. And what's interesting is like whenever I look it up, most of the examples in TV happened after this. So we see this and we're like, oh yeah, we've all seen a scene where like it's a nice song, but someone's getting killed. That's super common. But this was 1996. So like this was probably a fucking big deal.
Yeah.
At least for TV again, because
it certainly couldn't have been that widespread in like prestige television.
Right. Now literally every prestige television show like
does gets it at least like twice a season or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Every single Mad Men, Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, fucking Dexter, like Angel, Buffy, everything has done this. It's still good. It's a trope I enjoy a lot. Even if it is definitely, because we were talking about earlier when you were watching with your friend, it just kind of tells you, like, here's how you're supposed to feel. The opposite of the music is the correct response to this scene. I just like it a lot.
So here's a question I have for you.
Yeah.
About this juxtaposition.
Uh-huh.
How does the song affect how you are interpreting the action that's being taken?
Part of it is the fact that the song's lyrics are about sinners not being able to escape.
Yep.
Which is like, that's just appropriate. That's just like subtext being made text. There's no subtlety about that.
Right.
But the happiness of it kind of ties into the fact, the same thing I was saying earlier, where like because the religious leaders are actually rebels, like they're kind of associating like religious fervor and happiness with like political plays and moves for the throne, which is interesting.
Well, I sort of was wondering, the question that it made me think was, there's one reading that the lyrics are about Rifa, that he's the sinner who like couldn't hide. And he's like running around and trying to hide.
Yes.
But there's also another reading, or really multiple readings of who the sinners are. I think you could also read it as a scene that's about Jakar, because Jakar doesn't fight or attack.
Right.
Like Jakar, he just walks out. Is trying to hide from the responsibility for like this kind of brutal thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he is conflicted about his people being used for the infighting of the Centauri. I think he's conflicted about like this sort of just like mob violence behavior doesn't feel dignified in the way that he's mm-hmm. dignified.
Right.
And I think maybe he's thinking like at some point, you know, I'm going to have to pay for what I've done, or like these guys are going to have to pay for what they've done.
I think in that way, I kind of agree with that read. It kind of paints Jakar as like objectively better than Londo then, because Londo has seen like opportunities and taken them and like only felt regret briefly and then done the same thing again.
Yeah.
Whereas Jakar is like teetering on the edge of a really bad mistake and taking the first opportunity, but he like isn't leaning too hard into it. He's not like gleefully being a part of this. He kind of wants to get out. He kind of wants to escape already. Part of that to me is from Jakar's religious background and this sort of like fear of absolution and this desire to return to a better state that has always been such an integral part of Jakar's character that I don't think Londo has had. Londo, although he wants to like restore the former glory of the Centauri Empire, he doesn't care how he gets there. Jakar is like, I want to get back to a good time without feeling bad. But he still did this. He still partook in this, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's a conflict that's unique and different from Londo's in a meaningful way, but it's still a person running away from their from the actions that they have led to. I'm excited to see where Jakar's stuff goes. Because now he's involved with the Army of Light, too, as we know. He's involved with the Shadow War. And he now technically owes Londo. right? Or I guess not.
Well, no,
because
Lando
freed him.
Kind of an even trade, it seems like.
But he still partook in like petty squabbles of men, of just like Centauri conflict. So he will feel bad about that for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's very heavy stuff, though. And again, this scene is like one of the most famous scenes in the show for a reason. It's a big fucking deal that Reefa's dead. And now again, there's a freaking power vacuum in the Centauri society, just like when the last Emperor died. So, I mean, conflict is going to continue.
But, well, yeah, but Reefa wasn't the Emperor, so.
True, but what it means is that Lando now has a straight shot for Cartagia's throne.
True. Yeah.
He has a clean shot. So how he chooses to take that next season, we'll have to see. I think that's what I have, though, for this episode, man.
Yeah, same.
Exhaustive discussion, but very good. Very, very good stuff. Mm-hmm. One of the best. I would like to ask you what we're watching next week on Chatsalon 5.
Yeah, you want me to tell you?
I do.
Okay. All right, I'll tell you.
Thanks.
So, you know, we're kind of in a weird spot. We did watch one of these two things already. We just didn't have the time to record about all of it. But we are watching next week the last two episodes of Babylon 5 Season 3. Can you believe it?
I cannot.
We'll be 3/5 of the way through the whole show. Hmm. First up is Season 3, Episode 21, Shadow Dancing. The Shadows launch a major offensive.
That is definitely one read on what happens in Shadow Dancing.
Yeah.
I'm excited to talk about the Franklin stuff. I'm excited to talk about...
Oh, I forgot about the Franklin stuff completely.
It's so ridiculous.
It's cool, though.
Yeah, and then the last moment is like, oh, Babylon 5 is here. Hello.
Yeah. Hey. All right. And then... Season 3, Episode 22, Zahadum. Londo's political status changes. The history and motives of the Shadows are revealed.
Oh, I thought it was literally just going to be Londo's political status changes, period. Done. Good season. Yeah, guys. We're getting there. I mean, they're going to go, right? They're going to go. Is someone going to die in Zahadum? On Zahadum? Probably. I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know.
We're in uncharted territory now, folks. This is exciting stuff. Before we take it to the plug zone, I want to read the emails that we got this week because we got quite a few. And I also want to shout out some people for being awesome through via the emails. Via. It's an endlessly useful joke. Goodness gracious, Aloysius. Paul emailed us in, first of all, to say, "Hi, guys. Just checking in to say I'm still enjoying the podcast as you guys work your way through Babylon 5.
But.
What the fuck? No, he also says, "I was delighted at your reaction to War Without End and thought I would add the following few points that may not have occurred on your first watch through, trying to figure out what's actually happening. First, it's not clear where the Triluminary, which is the device that Delenn and Sinclair used to transform, came from. Mm. It seems Delenn gives it to Sinclair to take with him back with Babylon 4, but where Delenn gets it in Season 1 from isn't clear. It's possible they both give it to each other, meaning that somehow it's never created, but it travels around in time." I thought there was a scene in Babylon Squared where she's given the Triluminary by the Grey Council. I thought that was the point of the end of that episode.
I don't remember.
It's been decades since we watched. That's fair. He concludes, "Secondly, the whole of Minbari society since B4 arrived 700 years ago is based on Valen's prophecy that the Grey Council would last until Delenn would break the Council, which she did in Severed Dreams. Except, it wasn't prophecy because Valen as Sinclair would have known the history of Minbar until he travels back with Babylon 4. So, for the first time in 700 years, the future of Minbari society is unclear. This will have big consequences that play out in the following seasons." Isn't that wild?
Whoa, yeah.
So it's like their Bible ended with War Without End, because then he just went back. It's like, and then you guys went back.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
So their history hasn't, they have no history anymore, or they have no like plan or prophecies. It's wild.
That's nuts.
Anything can happen. I love it. I really love it. He also said, with regard to the much-discussed Grey 17 is missing, I saw a clip on YouTube of JMS talking about his writing process. And he said that the better the episode was, the easier it was for him to write. And that Grey 17 took him ages.
Hmm.
Keep up the good work and thanks. Hmm. Thank you, Paul. Yeah, yeah. Grey 17, it's a messy one. We all know that. Magellan, we still have a double batch of Dan emails this week. Do you want to read the first of them?
Yeah. The which one? Signs Importance? Or no, that's too old.
War Without End. Yeah, Signs Importance is the book's one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. All right. So this email comes to us from our buddy Dan. It's about War Without End, and Dan says, so much to say about War Without End, but this way, with this way come in...
This may come in a bit too late.
So much to say about War Without End, but this may come in a bit too late. Like Magellan, I was doing a bit of traveling, and I've been trying to catch up.
Nice.
First of all, one of the things that blew me away about the TNT cut of the pilot movie The Gathering was a line that was added to hint at the events of War Without End. In this cut, we hear into Kosh's mind when he greets Sinclair, and in it, we hear him think, Entil Za Valen, as he shakes Sinclair's hand. Of course, Entil Za is the Mimbari honorific given to the leader of the Rangers, and Valen is Valen. It's this massive spoiler right out of the gate, but new viewers could completely miss it because it just sounds like alien nonsense at the time and is easily dismissed. And while War Without End seems to cash in a bunch of chips that were built up as far back as the first season, including the episode Babylon Squared, it's not quite that simple, because it never is. The events that we get in War Without End are beautiful and big, and it's a fantastic send-off for the Sinclair character, but it doesn't even remotely match the plan that was in place during the time of Babylon Squared. I give JMS a lot of credit for pulling this all together and making it work, despite just how completely things had been derailed from his plans back in season one, the key factor being the exit of the Jeffrey Sinclair character.
Please, the Jeffrey Sinclair character. Thank you.
You're welcome. At this point, I'd like to bring up Babylon Prime. As lore would have it, back when JMS pitched Babylon 5 to execs, part of his pitch was that Babylon 5 would run its 5 years completely on the cheap, and if there was any success with the show, they would proceed with a spin-off show called Babylon Prime that would have a bigger budget.
What?
In this plan, none of the major arcs would be concluded at the end of B5's run. It would have ended with Delenn, Sinclair, and their baby escaping Babylon 5 right before it's destroyed by the Mimbari warrior cast, and then have them traveling through time to get Babylon 4 so they can continue the fight, because at that point in the story, EarthGov, the Mimbari, the Vorlons, and the Shadows would all be gunning for them for various reasons. And during these time shenanigans, their baby would have been advanced bodily to adulthood, but still would have had the mind of a child.
Oh, God.
He would also be the chosen one from the various Mimbari prophecies. It would be in this spin-off where all of the arcs would be concluded. The script notes that I occasionally reference lay out the Babylon Prime story notes. As wild as all of it sounds, I'm glad that we got what we got, which, rest assured, is nothing like all of that craziness.
Fuck.
I'd say that you guys have crossed a barrier with this one that opens you up to other things if you happen to be interested. For one thing, I'd argue that you've seen enough that it's safe to watch the tertiary pilot in the beginning. Chronologically, it's the first movie episode in the Babylon 5 story, but it kind of spoils things that I would say are no longer spoilers to you. Also, if you ever feel like reading the one canon Babylon 5 book, To Dream in the City of Sorrows, you're safe to do that now. Also, you can check out an interesting Babylon 5 comic called In Valen's Name, in which Sheridan and crew find the crumbling remains of a 1,000-year-old Babylon 4, and while they're dealing with hostilities, they also discover the records of two of Valen's closest followers, one from the religious cast and one from the warrior cast. I feel like I have more to say, but I'll leave it at that. I'm sure I've said more than enough. And that's from Dan.
Dan, you're a good person.
That was a wonderful email.
That Babylon Prime stuff sounds bananas. I can't even fathom what a show like that is, where they just are basically doing Babylon 5 again, but only a couple people know what happened, and it's like Sheridan, Sinclair rather, Sheridan wouldn't exist in this version. Delenn and their kid who has the mind of a child with the body of an adult. No, I'm good. This is one of those situations where I'm kind of glad that they have a network telling them that they have to like make certain adjustments, because that kind of sounds like unbridled nonsense, but maybe it would have been interesting. Who knows? And then I'm actually excited to check out To Dream in the City of Sorrows, because I've heard nothing but excellent things about it, and it's good to know that I can read it now. But thank you, Dan, for that. This next email is from Dan, because our recording schedule got to a way where we weren't able to read emails last time we recorded, so that's why we're reading old stuff. Regarding Walkabout and Gray 17 is Missing, Dan says, the new purple Kosh is also a character from To Dream in the City of Sorrows. Whoa! All right, well, you've confirmed I'm going to read it. Setting aside the philosophical We Are All Kosh stuff, this new Kosh is actually named Ulkesh, though you'll never hear that in the actual series. Dr. Franklin's last inappropriate romantic relationship with a patient, or patient's close family, I think I made a passing comment suggesting would be happening again, though the circumstances would be slightly different. Oh, Kaylin is the last one, is what he's saying. With Kaylin, he's technically not her doctor, but he does treat her like a patient, and that is before he learns that she's suffering from a fatal disease. It's good that Franklin learns that he's not just a scientist and a doctor, but rather that he's a scientist, a doctor, and DTF. Thank you. Also, somebody tweeted at us confirming or correcting us that Kaylin doesn't actually die in the end of the episode. She like leaves to get medical treatment.
Yeah.
It's from user Merv, who said Kaylin sang the songs and JMS wrote the lyrics. She didn't die at the end of the episode. So that was just a minor mistake. It doesn't change the point of what we were saying, where it's like he didn't learn anything or he like didn't succeed. But good to note. Anyways, to continue with Dan's email, Walkabout heavily implies that a piece of the original Kosh did survive inside of Sheridan. At this point, I guess this is a revelation that Vorlons can put bits of themselves in other people. But it answers the question of a scene we saw in Gethsemane when Leda and Kosh were in his quarters and we saw the lights coming out of Leda and going into Kosh. It's not shocking, then, that it's Leda who keeps getting glimpses of Kosh every time she's around Sheridan, to the point where at the end of the episode, when she tells Ulkesh she thinks she found a piece of Kosh after all. Oh, that's... okay. Since you guys were amused by the musical transition of Holding Frame on Ulkesh while some jazzy lounge music played in Walkabout, I'll be interesting to hear your takes on the musical scene in the rock cried out, No Hiding Place. It's an interesting juxtaposition. Understatement of the century, Dan. Thank you. I think you guys squarely hit upon why Grey 17 is so referenced. I know I've brought it up a couple times, and I think of it as the quintessential episode of what qualifies as bad in this point of the show, and in season 4 to some extent. It's an episode that has an abysmal A-plot that maybe shouldn't have made it to TV, but it's coupled to a B-plot that's fantastic, and is everything a good B5 episode should be. The nonsensical idea that a significant portion of the station could be missing and go unnoticed is one thing, but that it's also filled with a death cult and the monster that's eating them, just get me to the Minbari power struggle. On that note, though, I did like Magellan's observations about whether or not Delenn is right to consolidate so much power. Even if they win against the Shadows, Delenn will still have 2/3 of the Minbari people behind her, a not small military force, and the military 1/3 who are squirming at the idea that a religious leader has effectively seized control of their government without any sort of due process. I'd assume you guys are... I would say that you guys are right to assume that there will be some sort of reckoning down the road. I don't know that Narun is right, but he certainly holds a reasonable opinion that any person in his position might hold good. And finally, one of the general criticisms that some of the fandom had about the later seasons was a thematic turn that B5 seemed to take. In the early seasons and for much of season 3, one of the basic themes was very Lord of the Rings in nature. It was that unchecked power was dangerous in anybody's hands. We saw that with Nightwatch, the rise of the Clark regime, we saw an affable, good-timing Londo Malari fall into darkness. We see glimpses of that with Psycops and Psycor and Bester, and anyone who had any significant power was corrupted by it. But we've reached this point in the show where a new theme seems to be taking over, it being, unchecked power is fine as long as it's in the hands of the right people. Actions always have consequences in the show, but I don't know that it fully conquers this particular theme.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we were worried or concerned about, I guess, in talking about the Delenn conflict stuff, is like, do they know that Sheridan being a war boy is kind of bad? Do they really? Are they going to get into that? So who knows? But thank you, Dan. These are all good questions for us to consider in the future. And then just briefly, our last email is just a fun one from listener Nick, who says, "Hi guys, I wanted to add to the suggestion before by Patrick's email to watch season 5, then 1 through 4, and then season 5 episode 2 should be the last episode of your rewatch." Season 5 episode 22 should be the last one. "This works better because that episode was going to be the finale for season 4 when there was no season 5 confirmed. So even the feel of the episode is very much like the rest of season 4. I've signed up for the Patreon, and I hope you take it as a slow-paying bribe for the condition that you never watch the Babylon 5 movie/TV pilot, Legend of the Rangers. It's a hot pile of garbage, and I wish it didn't exist. Here's the thing. I don't actually... Thank you for being a patron so much. You're amazing. Yeah, we love you.
We love our patrons.
We have to watch everything."
Yeah, sorry. That's part of our blood oath that we take.
Exactly.
To each other.
Yep. We opened it on a stone, and that stone is lying somewhere in the middle of the Mojave Desert, and it says on it specifically, "Alan and Magellan will watch every episode and movie of every show they watch." Sorry. He says thanks, and then signs it, "Nicholas, twin brother of Patrick, who I challenge to match my Patreon." So I'm just gonna say Nick backed. Let's say I think he backed $100 a month.
I think you missed some zeros, my friend. He backed $100,000.
Yeah. So Patrick, you're gonna have to match your brother. Also, text your brother.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for being patrons. That's so awesome. And I love this sibling rivalry that may or may not begin to happen now in our Patreon. Speaking of which, let's take it to the plug zone. Take this train home. Patreon.com/chatspod is where you can get access to all sorts of fun bonus content. At $2 a month, you get our monthly show Commentary Chats, where we watch a movie every month, and you can listen to us talk about it while we're watching it. This month, for the month of May, we actually just put out the commentary for Hook, which is a movie that I did not expect to be what it was. it's. What did you think of Hook, Magellan? What was your general take?
It's nice.
It's a sweet film. It's also darker than I thought. You'll just watch it. If you've already seen it, listen to the commentary. It's great. It's a good time. And then at $5 a month, every other week, we do chats nights where we hang out and we're friends. And actually, a recent patron asked that we listen to/read one of the interlude chapters from the online novel called Worm. And it's sequel Ward. I'm trying to get my facts correct. So it's an interlude chapter from Ward, and it's really fucking good, and they asked us to read it and talk about it on nights, and we're going to do that for the next episode. Mm-hmm. It's good stuff. You too can be a patron and tell us to consume media that we wouldn't have normally experienced. So thanks for that. You guys rock. Chatspod@gmail.com if you have emails, @chatspod on Twitter if you have comments like that. Rate us on iTunes and your podcast platform of choice. Really helps get the show out there. We love that. We have exciting plans for the future, too. So stay tuned to all of the socials. Yeah. Magellan, what is your chatsum for this week?
My chatsum for this week, I don't watch a lot of TV.
But when I do, I prefer Dos Equis.
Which is kind of funny, I guess, given that we do a TV podcast. I used to watch a lot more TV when I was in college and stuff. I definitely don't watch a lot of current stuff, but the one show that I like recently enjoyed and I'm catching up on and I'm going to watch currently, that if you haven't seen it, it's worth looking at, is a comedy on NBC called AP Bio. And I haven't done this one, right? I told you about it, but it wasn't a night.
Right. I was literally thinking the same thing. Let me check.
I'm pretty sure I didn't do it as a night.
As a chatsum.
Or as a chatsum. Whoops.
Yeah. Too many terms. Hold on. I can tell you. It would have been the last couple of weeks, right?
Yeah. Is this not up to date?
No, this is up to date.
Yeah.
You haven't talked about it.
I talked about Frida Kahlo. I didn't. Yeah, Elizabeth Warden, Frida Kahlo. That's right. Yeah, I didn't talk about this. We're good. So I've been watching this show, AP Bio, which is on NBC, like I said. And it's Glenn Howerton is the main guy who plays Dennis on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And he's kind of just doing that character, but not, it's not as like haunting, I guess, because the show's a little lighter. But basically, he plays this like former Harvard philosophy professor who's been disgraced and has moved home to live in his dead mom's house in Toledo. And he's working at a high school teaching AP biology, except he comes in the first day and to the kids is like, I'm not doing that. I'm not teaching you that.
Yeah.
We're just going to sit in this room together. And then it kind of, the best way I can describe it is it turns into like, oh, what's a good thing to pair this with? I would say like, kind of like Assassination Classroom meets, what's a good example? Assassination Classroom meets like Better Off Ted or something.
Okay.
Where it's like a single camera show that each character is kind of like quirky, has their thing, and it's like a little tongue-in-cheek, but it still takes the characterization somewhat seriously. And then like the kids each have their own bit. And the teacher is like this dark character that they're trying to get rid of because they hate him, but also they love him. It's got that going on. So, it's funny. I recommend it, and you should watch it.
All of the above. Yeah. Should watch it. Do recommend. Do like it. It's good.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I really like Glenn Howerton. I want to see it just to see what his performance is like in a different context and kind of like, you know, see the cast sounds fun.
Yeah, it's kind of, there's sort of a bummer aspect to it of like, he really is just doing that
Dennis.
Same character.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that he's got more in the tank there. It's slightly different. Like there's nuance to it, but I want to see him do more different things. But it's still cool that he's got his own vehicle.
Definitely.
What's your Chatson?
My Chatson for this week is actually also a TV show, coincidental.
No way.
I honestly watch too much TV right now. I was just talking about how I want to like start canceling subscriptions to different various like cable network services. But I'm really like earnestly attracted and enjoying this new Twilight Zone series a lot. It's on CBS All Access, just like the my previous Chatson of mine, Star Trek Discovery. And since that season ended, Twilight Zone has been like the only reason I keep this subscription. Mm-hmm. And they're, as of this recording, 8 episodes into the season. And each episode, it's like reimagining a modern take on the whole like 45 minutes, little allegory about life or our times or our politics with a plot twist at the end. That's what Twilight Zone kind of is. I used to watch a lot of Twilight Zone, the old series, like around Thanksgiving, because they would put it on CBS, actually. And then it was like on Netflix, and I tried getting into it there. And we watched it in school, because they were always like, moral plays are good for the kids. This new one is like not good in the sense that I can't recommend it in like, it is important television.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it kind of thinks it is, but it's just so absurd. And the twists are so incredibly good and funny that if you just have like 30 to 45 minutes to just like sit down and look at something, mm-hmm. and you're like, yeah, these performances are fine, this is fine, I know what they're doing, oh, they weren't doing this, that's somehow dumber than what I thought, like it's just so profoundly silly. There's probably the most joy I got out of an episode was the end of season 1 episode 5 called The Wunderkind, which is about a guy who thinks that he can get anyone elected, and then he gets an 8-year-old elected for president of the United States. And it kind of gets wacky from there. Like, they're all weird. There's like, and the other thing too is they kind of like really stretch to, they swing for the fences. There's an episode about Black Lives Matter. There's an episode about immigration and how we don't treat Native Americans well. You know, there's an episode about like the, like Me Too / Not All Men, like that whole feminist movement and anti-feminist movements and that kind of thing, framed as a zombie story. And it's like, what do you, why are you, why? But they do it. And it's kind of fun too, because I used to be into Black Mirror, which is similar, like a modern day Twilight Zone. But I think the difference is that Black Mirror is very, like, it really believes its own bullshit. It swallows its own bullshit and is like,
yeah, it really thinks that it's a serious commentary.
Where it's just like, no, Twilight Zone is like, no, this is dumb. We know it's dumb. You're going to enjoy it and then laugh at the twist and forget about this episode a week later. So give it a shot. I know it's probably not worth checking out CBS All Access just for this, but you can do like a trial and just like watch all the episodes. There are not a lot of them. So peep that. Get educated. Watch TV like we do. And thank you very, very much for listening to this episode of Chat Salon 5. Peace.